And now I ask Roger Peterson to introduce our program.
I'm coming, Roger.
Sitting here, I can just hand her the mic. I promised Debbie I wouldn't say everything I know about her. Debbie and I used to work together at Telesensory, and I considered her one of my people that kept me sane insofar as I was sane at that time. I knew her even before that, from before she came to work at Telesensory, when we had BayTalk. I used to go to BayTalk meetings over in Berkeley, and she was one of the leaders of the BayTalk computer user group, and she's been a leader of consumer-oriented assistive technology. She used to have a business called Grassroots Computing, which sounds kind of Berkeley-esque, doesn't it? And like that. So, and now she's the alternate media person at De Anza, which means she helps all the students get what they need in the media they need it in. And she's otherwise all kinds of interesting person. So I actually met her in the 70s when I applied for the job as director of the Disabled Student Program at UC Berkeley. But anyway, here she is, Debbie Norling, or Armstrong, or whatever.
Okay, and Roger, I'm going to make you in charge of my coffee cup. Okay. There's my coffee cup. I have this coffee cup that's a little tippy. It has a lid on it, so I'm making Roger in charge. If it spills all over him, well, it's his outfit. I can stand up so I can kind of look around. What I want to do is just tell you a little bit about myself, and then you guys can ask a lot of questions, because I'm 50, so I've lived a long time, and I have a lot of stories, and some people like some of them, and other people think some of them are kind of boring. Yeah, I know, it's really scary, isn't it? I'm 50, and I'm menopausal, so what else can I say? Or it's like these alcoholics, I'm menopausal, and I'm not ashamed. Anyway, So I'm going to do my life story, but I'm going to try to be pretty brief. And I promised Mike I would practice not talking fast. So I'm going to practice for him and for all of us. I was born in the late 50s. I was right in the middle of the baby boom. And I was one of the first blind children in the East Bay to be mainstream. There were a few ahead of me. Dan Kaiser was ahead of me. The most famous person, but he was pretty sighted then. He was always zooming around on a skateboard, so he was only really a fake blind person in those days. But I was one of the early mainstreamers. I went to school and had the resource room program like a lot of other blind children. I actually had no vision. I mean, I had an itty bitty amount of color perception if I held something really close to my face, but I was teased so much for sniffing colors when I was a little kid, I didn't demonstrate it too often. And I actually had a cornea transplant when I was 20, and so my eye actually sees 2400, but my brain doesn't see. I have the cerebral cortex of the visual cortex of a newborn, so I have a little bit of vision. And so what is really interesting with it is that occasionally I will just out of the blue sort of see stuff, and then most of the time I don't see anything. So it's a little bizarre. And so people who know me from different places have different ideas of how much I see. And about the only person who really knows whether I will or will not see something is...
We all know you're bizarre.
That's right. That's right. So I will occasionally appear to have some vision, and then the second later I'll appear to not have any, and that's exactly the way it really is. So I would say 90% of the time I don't see anything, and then suddenly I'll have flashes of it. And I do not see shape. I see color. So, and the concept of seeing shape to me is as foreign as the concept of reading minds. And so if I walk into a room and there are five green things, I really can't tell you which is the plant and which is the person in a green dress sitting in a green chair. I always take a minute to explain that to people, because it was much easier to have no vision, truthfully. So I'm not actually really a low vision person. I cannot read print. I can see whether the computer's in DOS or Windows, and that's, and only sometimes. Okay, so that's enough with the vision business. When I was a teenager, I decided I wanted to go to Germany to become an exchange student. My mom was a counselor for exchange students. She believed teenagers should learn to get along with other teenagers. So she had kids that lived at our house all the time, and she always had problem kids. So she had teenagers who hadn't worked out with their first host family who had to stay with us. And so I was always sharing, when I was a teenager, I never had my own room. I was always sharing my room with somebody from Brazil or Lithuania or wherever. We were the host, and Roger's absolutely right. We were the host family of last resort. And I'm very much a dweeb, very much an introvert. However, I have this veneer of social skills that I picked up because I had to share my room with all these people. So my mom taught me how to have social skills. And so it's sort of funny because I know what they are and I know how to have them, but I actually prefer to hide out in my office and play with my computers than deal with people. So... But because I grew up with so many different teenagers in my house, I do know how to get along with people, and I think that has served me well, and helped with my naturally introverted tendencies. So I decided I want to be an exchange student. I did live in Germany for a year. It was wonderful. I wrote thousands of pages of letters home. I have a huge box of them. One day I'm going to scan them and write my autobiography. And I went to a blind school in Marburg. I'd never been to a school for the blind before. That was kind of a shocking experience. It was one of 17 schools for the blind in Germany. So that's their stories about that. So that I was like 18. And I went to the 13th grade in Germany. So I graduated from American high school, and I attempted to graduate from German high school. I don't think I was actually that good. Yeah, it was called Blindenstudienanstalt, which stands for Blind Students Institution. Anstalt is also the word used for insane asylum and other things. Blind Students Asylum is probably a better translation. Yeah, it was a little bit backward, but it was the most forward place in Germany at the time. This was the 70s, late 70s, 75, 76. Anyway, so when I came back from Germany, I went to Chabot for a couple of years. That was typical junior college experience. I was a little bit of a high achiever, so I had good grades, and I was taking 22 units a quarter. I was a low achiever in high school. I really didn't like school. I didn't do my homework. I was a high achiever at Chabot. I'm not sure where the switch got flipped. There's this great Simpsons program where they have this doll, and it's doing bad things, and I think it's Bart Simpson who flips the switch from evil to good. Just flips that switch. Oh, now it's good. So somewhere along the line, someone flipped the switch from low motivation to high motivation for me. I don't know how that happened, but I have not always been a high achiever. And I've been at both ends of the spectrum, where I really didn't do a whole hell of a lot, and also where I've been really working hard to make something happen. See, I'm speeding up. I must not speed up.
Don't worry about it.
So then I went to UC Berkeley, and I dropped into my low achieving mode. I got through a few years of it, but I wasn't very successful. I was very active in the DSU. I worked full time, and I loved having a job. Yeah. Yeah. I loved having a job. I loved being an activist, but I didn't like being a student. So I dropped out in 1982. I did not get my degree. And then a couple of years later, I decided that I really wanted to learn computers. And someone flipped that switch again. I don't know. First, I was sitting around on SSI doing absolutely nothing. And all of a sudden, my little switch flipped, and I went back into high achiever mode. And I put a sign up on campus saying I would type for people with disabilities, quadriplegics. And I was hired by all these people with physical disabilities to enter mostly Fortran computers into the mini computer on campus. And I would sit in the bowels of Evans Hall on people's wheelchair foot pedals and type for them. And I'd sit on their foot pedals so they could see the screen. And then, you know, I'd be perched on this guy's foot pedals typing. And he'd look over my long hair at the screen and say, whoops, wait a minute, tab down. wait a minute, type L. and so I got a really good computer science education at UC Berkeley without actually having to take a test or attend any classes, which was perfect for me because I kind of got to do the high achiever thing without having turning any homework. And then after that, oh, I don't know. You know, I wasn't a dweeb then. I remember it was an IBM 3001 terminal, 3101, I believe, and the operating system was CMS, but I can't tell you what the mini computer mainframe was. Remember, I was just the data entry. But, you know, I learned a lot of Fortran. I don't remember any of it, but I remember helping a guy cheat. I helped him write a calculator in Fortran. I had a knack for programming, yeah. That was really, really one of these things. I just had a knack for programming. The way some people have a knack for music, I am not very musical. I really believe that a lot of my computer skills are not native intelligence as much as talent, just the way some people can pick up the piano. And for some reason, I was real good at programming. So I'm going on and on. Let's see. So I started doing contract programming in the 1980s. I programmed in DBase 3 and Clipper for a while. I also enrolled in a junior college course so I could put another notice in the paper that said, blind college student seeks donation of computer, because I was still pretty poor. These quadriplegics weren't paying me a fortune, you know, minimum wage to type for them. And I actually had 5 computers donated to me. It was just amazing. People had all these computers they didn't want. And I gave some of them away because I really couldn't handle more than a couple. Actually, it was very unscientific. I went to the Recording for the Blind catalog and I looked for manuals and information about the 5 computers that were donated to me, and I gave away all the ones that I couldn't find anything in the RFB catalog about. And everything else I kept. I had a TRS-80 Model 1, and later I had an early IBM PC. And I used those to learn how to program some more. And then I was able to get these jobs programming in Clipper and in DBase. Then I got tired of that. And I decided to write my own screen reader because the screen readers of the time weren't that good. So I wrote the 4th screen access program for the IBM PC. And it was not one of the best ones, but it was one of the best ones at the time. Also, I'm still the only girl to have written a screen access program for the PC that I know of. I don't know why other girls are not doing this. Programming doesn't have to, hacking does not have to be a profession for men. It's pretty fun if you're a girl, too.
How was your screen reader different from the ones done by men?
Well, it was the first one to read pop-up windows. It was the first one to read sentences and paragraphs. Now, when everybody copied me, their screen readers did a better job of pop-up windows and sentences and paragraphs, and I'm not afraid to admit it. It was not the best screen reader, but it had a lot of innovations.
Video Voice.
Video Voice. And the thing about Video Voice was that it wasn't a super great program, but it was an innovator. A lot of other programs followed it quickly and copied it and did a much better job. And one of the reasons many people did a better job is because these guys had been programming longer than me. I mean, some of the screen reader authors were actually, programming before I was born. So, you know, I was still pretty much a kid. Yeah. Oh, I have many funny stories about Flipper, but that's.
How many copies of your program do you think you got out there into the world?
I think we probably sold about 5,000. One of the things we did that everybody else didn't do is we sold Video Voice for $100. Everybody else was selling their screen reader for over $500. We sold it for about $100. And the other thing we did, and my best friend pretty much ran the company. She always said it was my company because it was my company on paper. But my best friend, Christy, ran the company, and she did everything but program. And I programmed and didn't do anything else. Well, I did some tech support. Yeah, yeah. But we wanted it that way because I hate sales. I absolutely hate sales. I don't want to do it. And that was our agreement. If I had to do any sales, you could find another programmer. I like to tell people the truth. So anyway, so I wrote... I kept working on Video Voice, and it got surpassed by many other programs, and I eventually sold the company for a dollar to someone in Arizona who was actually a pretty good friend of ours. And I was able to do something else. I was able to gracefully exit without feeling too bad about it. And after I had been working on grassroots computing and video voice for about a decade, I started to work at Stenograph Corporation, and they're the place that makes court reporting equipment. So I did tech support, and later I did tech writing, and much later I trained court reporters how to use steno machines and how to use the software that controls them, which is called CAT, computer aided transcription. So I learned a lot about the court reporting industry. I learned steno. I'm not very good, though. You wouldn't want me in a courtroom. I'm about 9 words a minute. It's a toss-up whether I can read faster with the Opticon or type in steno faster, but I learned it well enough to support it, which is the important thing. I've always been impressed about how accessible a profession court reporting is and how underdeveloped it is as a profession for blind people. And it requires...
Now there's real-time captioning.
Oh, yeah. Well, it requires an intermediary person who's fairly technical who can get all that stuff working with screen access. And if you can get it working with screen access, court reporting is really accessible. But because I did tech support for Stenograph, I knew, at least in those days, how to get all those systems working with the screen access that was around. Anyway, I worked there for 5 years, and I really, really loved the job. But they offered me a chance to move to Chicago. And I turned them down because I didn't want to wait for the bus in the snow. And so I got a nice bonus for staying until they cleared out the whole California division. So absolutely everybody in California was laid off or offered a job in Chicago. So they phased all of us in California out, and I was downsized. I had to look for another job. I was unemployed for a year, and I did my usual switching between being up about it and being down about it. But I finally did find a job at Telesensory, and that's where I worked with Roger for 3 years. And I really loved working there, too, very much so. And I what I loved the most, I think, was this balance between working in the sighted world and then working in the blindness field. You know, so many of us have either worked all our lives in the disability world, or we've worked outside and never gotten to do anything with disability stuff. And I feel very, you know, blessed that I've been able to do both, because I think it makes me a more balanced person. I can certainly tell stories about Telesensory, but I'm yammering on, and I wanted to finish my life. This is the problem of being 50.
Well, let's hope you don't finish it.
When I finished, when I was downsized at Telesensory, you know, you guys all know that Roger was laid off. Well, I was laid off too, a few years later, and under similar circumstances, except I got a little more time to gather up my stuff. But it was basically the same idea that we were bought, and they didn't want our division. And after I was laid off, I was really lucky because it was the .com boom, and I found a job almost instantly at CARE, and. I think part of the reason I found that job so fast was because I looked through all of the software on my shelf and I said, well, gee, what software do I have that I actually own that I can just call the company and try to seduce them into hiring me? And that's, I think, was a really interesting approach, and it worked. CARE makes OCR software and made OCR software, and their software is kind of the underpinning or the basis for much of what we see today in OpenBook and in Kurzweil. Just as an oversimplification, a little bit, but
did that become new?
People who are speaking without mics, are people interested in hearing this talk or couldn't come?
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter what company it became. It was another techie company, and I was another nerd, and it was a lot of fun. And I was on guide dog number 3 by then. But anyway, I worked there for a couple of years. I became a product lead. I still remember my first day there admiring the people who were the product leads, you know, the people that answered all the hard questions. I also learned some really interesting dirty little secrets about customer service and tech support, because they were in the process of trying to make technical support and customer service cheaper. They had always had training periods for tech support that lasted 6 weeks. like we did at Stenograph. They didn't put us on the phone at Stenograph until we had 6 weeks of training, and we knew what it was to be a court reporter, and we knew how the computers worked, and we all had pretty much computer science degrees except for me, because nobody asked and I didn't tell. But at CARE, they were really trying to save money, and so we outsourced much of our tech support, which means we hired a firm in Colorado to do the tech support, and they trained these people for about 3 days, and they were just basically people off the street. And as you know, nowadays, tech support and customer service is pretty much a high-tech sweatshop. You just get these people in there who, you know, have some social skills, and you put them on the phone, you train them in script, well, someone says my internet connection doesn't work, ask them questions A, B, and C, and then give them answer number D, you know, letter D. And they were going through that transition, so they still had this old school of people who really wanted techs to be technical. And then we had this other group that, being counters, that needed us to save money. And so it was much of a privilege to be there to watch that transition. I was one of the techs, and so I moved really quickly up the ladder, and I became in charge of the big account. So I didn't talk to real customers after a while. I talked to Kinko's. You know, Kinko's would say, well, we have 300 scanners, and they're not working with your product. And that's the kind of people I supported. I also supervised all of the group that we outsourced. So I would listen in on all the calls from Colorado and try to help them at least sound technical. And that was fun. So I had this huge board, and I would monitor all these calls that came in and try to help them. I remember some guy who was having trouble registering his software, and I remember a guy in Colorado who was who thought maybe he should help him edit his registry. So we had a lot of really funny things. One of my funniest stories at CARE was I had a braille display by that time because I had gotten sort of a reject one from Telesensory, had a giant scratch on the front. Worked great, but looked ugly. And I had this big, by that time I had this software switchboard, so it was all on the computer that had all these calls coming in. And I dropped a book on my braille display, and it hit the little router buttons, and it connected two guys to each other. And in my headphones, I hear this guy saying, I'm calling tech support. And the other guy said, I'm calling tech support. And the first guy said, I need help. I've been on the phone for an hour, and I can't get this thing to work. And I need to get this done. And this other guy said, what the hell are you talking about? I've been on the phone for an hour. And it was great. They both didn't realize that they were both customers. They were both trying to call support. They both thought the person they were talking to was support. And they got in this giant argument, and it was really funny. And I was just kind of listening. But most of my monitoring calls was less exciting, much less exciting. Anyway, I was there for 2.5 years, and then I got downsized. Again, they closed our California division. This was getting really old. This was time number 3 that I'd been downsized. But I was, again, really lucky. It was the dot-com boom, and I got hired almost immediately again by a company called Avio. Don't look for them because they are all out of business. They're another dot-com. And I was hired to program in a language called JavaScript that I didn't actually know. And I hadn't actually programmed for a decade now. And I told them this in the interview. But for some reason, they were really impressed. And I think the thing that they said is they were looking for people who were fast learners. And somehow I managed to lie my way through this interview. So they thought I was some sort of fast learner. So my first week in this job, I actually had to download every book I could find on the internet on JavaScript and learn how to program in it. I hadn't programmed in a decade. But later I realized that I was cheap. You know, they were paying me a lot less than they were paying a real JavaScript programmer who would have known what to do. So, I mean, I think I was being paid like $32,000. I wasn't making a lot for Silicon Valley money. I mean, a real JavaScript programmer probably would have made about $75,000. So in a lot of ways, they got a good deal because I got to learn a new programming language and I got to program again. And they got someone who was a fast learner. So I sat down and I learned it and I did a bunch of web applications for them. And their whole shtick in life was to design web pages that answered your question. So you put this AVIO server on your computer, and then after that, if you had a problem, and it sensed, it had this artificial intelligence, if it sensed you had a problem, a little web page would pop up and go, oh my goodness, you're having a problem. Let me help you select a block of text in Microsoft Word. Or I see your printer's out of ink. You know what? I know how to sell you some ink. Here, go on to this web page and we'll sell you some ink. And it was great. And I wrote all these. It was great. It's just the most intrusive, nosy, obnoxious piece of software I had ever supported. I remember one day asking somebody, you know, why do I have to know so much about these people? You know, isn't this kind of invasive? This was early spyware, you know. I didn't know I was writing spyware. That term didn't exist. But I was actually writing spyware. What would become to know, be known as adware. People would install this on their system knowing it was a helper application. You know, we weren't sneaky that way. People knew. But I didn't know it was going to, like, poke around the innards of their system and know every detail of their transactions, you know, on the Internet. And I remember asking somebody, you know, I think this is kind of invasive. I mean, do we really have to know when their printer's running low on ink and try to sell them ink without even asking their permission? And I remember the director of marketing saying to me, we're monetizing the customer base. And I just love that. So now every time a company does something I don't like, you know, nickels and dimes me, I say, oh, they're trying to monetize their customer base. So I did that for another 9 months, I suppose, because we can. Thank you, Roger. And so 9 months after that, I was happily puttering around on my computer one morning. I was actually reading the PC audio list while I was trying to figure out how to do something really tricky in JavaScript that I couldn't figure out. So I was like reading Jonathan Mosen's post on the PC audio list and trying to look like I was working. And my boss said, you need to come in this room for a minute. And there was about 300 of us in that room. It was really hot and sweaty. We were all crammed together. The room wasn't big enough for all of us. And he said, you cannot go back to your desks. I'm sorry, we're laying you all off. So there was my computer running the PC audio list and the JavaScript thing in another window, thank goodness, that I was having trouble with. And I had JAWS on it, and, you know, I had stuff backed up, and I didn't get to go back to my desk. All of us were escorted outside in the parking lot where it was pouring down rain. And I got someone to go back and get my raincoat, and that was about it. And I didn't have a job anymore, neither did any of the rest of us. The venture capitalists closed us down, and we just weren't going to get any more money, and they asked us to lay off all these people. So about two-thirds of the company was without a job that morning. And so I was kind of distraught, but I was okay. I was holding it together. My boss, who was a able-bodied young white male, was crying. He was just blubbering away. It was kind of sad, really very sad. I had been downsized so many times, you know, I wasn't even crying anymore. But, oh, every time I think about Kirk standing out there in the rain crying, it just gives me sort of the chills, because he was a young high achiever, and he really thought he was going to go somewhere with this company. I kind of had always had my doubts about monetizing the customer base, but he was a believer. Oh, my goodness. But so my husband had to quit, leave work, and come and get me, because they didn't call a cab for me like they did for Roger. No one thought about how Debbie was supposed to get home in the rain. But it... So when I tell Roger I feel for him, I really do, because I've been there, though. At least I was with about 300 other people, and I think I was less upset than most of them. So after that, it actually took me a year to find a job, which was sort of sad. But there weren't any jobs to be had. The one thing I did learn from that experience was how to interview, and I'm probably a more confident interviewer than many people. Interviewer, just because I blew so many interviews. I had a really disastrous interview at SAF where I was very flippant with them, and I don't think they'll ever like me again. I have stopped being sort of a team player now. You know, I really have. I mean, I've worked so many jobs now, I don't have to be like a job developer's dream, you know? I mean, I have a lot of skills, and I can be myself now, and that's kind of neat, actually. When I got hired at De Anza, they paid me more money than I have ever made in my life. I can actually go home at 5 in the afternoon. It's amazing. And I am responsible for alternate media. I make sure that all of the disabled students get things on cassette, MP3, DAISY, Braille, large print. I scan people's textbooks. Theoretically, I was supposed to supervise a department. I am my department. We are a department of one, me, and me. And I do all the alternate media for DeAnza, and it is a wonderful job. If I was young, I would say there isn't enough work, but I'm old enough now to know that, you know, sometimes there is too much work and I can't get everything done on time. And there are other periods where there's nothing to do, and I really like that. I also love working with the teenagers. I love the young people. Even if I'm kind of down and I think I'm never going to get anything done, somebody's mom brings me flowers and gives me a hug, and it's great. So I've yammered enough, and I probably took all the time.
And you knew Lupe there, right?
Yeah, I knew Lupe. I met Lupe, and I met Sam Chan. And I am very open, so I can answer any questions about any of my jobs or anything in my life, and I'm sorry I yammered so much.
Debbie, what's the biggest need the students have at the college that they come to you for?
I think I serve 90% of my students are LD. And the learning disabled. They have, or what they sometimes politically call learning differences. But, you know, I think it has nothing to do with LDS. Someone did want the Book of Mormon once in Kurtzwell. And I suggested that if we got rid of all that It Came to Pass, we could get the Book of Mormon to fit on one CD. But that's another story. I could just do a search and replace and change It Came to Pass to something else. It would take up a lot less room. But anyway. And I mean no offense to anybody. I have a quirky sense of humor, but I have great respect for for all religions. I think the biggest misunderstanding about students with learning differences is that many of them can see it and not read it, and many of them can hear it and not read it. But if they see and hear it both, all of a sudden some brain pathway comes unclogged. And so mostly I put things into Kurzweil 3000, and when they see it scrolling across the screen and their eyes follow it and their ears hear the electronic voice reading it, they can comprehend just as good as someone without a learning difference. For most of my students, that's the way it is. So their biggest need pretty much is to get the book into a format where they can see it and hear it, and that's usually Kurzweil, though sometimes we give it to them in audio and they follow along in the printed book too. So sometimes I'll give them an MP3. More questions.
So how does how would a person needing help get it? What did they have to do?
Well, we actually have less bureaucracy because I hate bureaucracy. And luckily, my boss is just disorganized enough. She doesn't notice how little bureaucracy I have. I make them fill out a form. I make them have a little chat with me about what their alternate media needs are, and that's about it. Foothill has a lot more bureaucracy. Many of the other colleges have more bureaucracy. I want to start getting to work on their book quick. I don't want to be a bureaucrat about it. So they do have to tell me they have a disability. For legal reasons, I need a form on file that says they really do have a disability. We've had some, we have been not sued exactly, but some students have had lawsuits where they have actually wanted to see my paperwork. So sadly, especially for some of the more nebulous disabilities like brain injuries, and I don't mean that it's not a real disability, but I mean legally nebulous. Right. I'm not saying that these people don't have disabilities, but I'm saying sometimes there's some question about whether it's a disability in the law books. And for them, I especially need to have that paperwork done.
How long have you been there?
How long have I been there? I've been there for almost 5 years. I was hired in 2002, in January. I was actually at Guide Dogs when I was hired, and they wanted me to come the next day, and I said, I'm sorry, I'm getting a new guide dog. So it was really bizarre, because I showed up on this 112-acre campus, have no clue where I'm going, and I have a brand-new guide dog, and I broke all the rules, because you're not supposed to take your brand-new guide dog to a new place when you don't know where you're going. More questions?
If I had to, suppose I was in a class, and I needed, I couldn't get the textbook, okay? The professor told me what the textbook was I was supposed to get, but I couldn't get it. Would you be able to help there?
Well, technically, I am supposed to see that you have purchased the textbook before I give it to you in alternate media. The reality is, a lot of times I will begin to work on their alternate media before I actually physically see a textbook. There are many situations where rehab won't buy someone their textbook right away. They have to get all sorts of authorizations taken care of. So I will attempt to see if another college has done the book. I will look through my own archive to see if I have done a scan of the book. I will try to get publisher e-text, which is another story. Sometimes I'm actually successful at that. But in general, I will try to work with a student, but at some point, especially if it's a student who I know typically would pull a fast one, rather than a student who just genuinely can't get a hold of the printed book, I will have to insist on seeing the printed textbook or seeing a receipt. What I typically do, though, is I have a lot of students who the bookstore didn't get the book in or rehab hasn't come through yet to pay for it, and I will let it slide for quite a while. And I may just tell the student's counselor, I haven't seen their book. I gave them their alternate media. Will you follow up? So I try again not to be a bureaucrat about it and still stay within the law.
Well, there was a, in the spring, no, it was in the, yeah, it was in the spring convention. There was a fellow from, there was a panel discussion about AB 437, I think it was, where the textbooks in alternate formats had to be produced by institutions so they'd be available to disabled people. Do you have anything to do with that? Do you know what I'm talking about, even?
Yeah, well, I'm not one of the activists who's trying to make that happen. I do go to panel discussions about it, sometimes at CSUN when I get there, when I get Deanza to pay for it. They don't always come through. Jeff, S-I-N-G-H, don't tell me to pronounce it. Yeah, he's been one of the leaders in making sure that happens. No, I mean, I just know that I'm legally required to make sure you get your textbook in alternate format. It's a little bit nebulous sometimes. Like right now, I'm doing a math book, and I cannot, I'm not going to braille any math. So what I do is I have to send away to have it done. And sometimes we contract with the ATPC, which is the Alternate Text Production Center at Ventura College, and they will be doing it for me and getting it back to me. So there are instances where they don't get it back to me as fast as I would like. And so, but probably by the time the student got to the point where he was ready to sue us, I probably did have it. And, I stand on both sides of this. I mean, as a blind person, I want people to have alternate media. And as a DeAnza employee, sometimes my hands are tied because I'm waiting for someone up the line to finish doing the alternate media. So it's kind of frustrating. Next question?
Yeah, coming. I'm thinking about the LD students who need these special, all kinds of special media. What kind of careers are they going into? Will the careers that they're going into have available to them these multimedia things? I mean, they're not going to be brain surgeons. Does DeAnza have landscaping or, courses that they can handle once they no longer have your help with the media?
Well, I think, the thing is that everybody with a learning difference is very, very different. And you see some people, and usually we're talking about the success-oriented people, who start out needing all sorts of help, and then they gradually wean themselves away from that help. And let's take the example of someone who just lost their vision. They may not be able to cross a room unaided. They certainly can't learn Braille. And then, 10 years from now, they may be just a whopping success, travel the whole country alone, do things you and I never dreamed of doing independently. And I think that's the same with these people of learning differences. I mean, sometimes they, if you cannot see and read print, you're always not going to be able to read print unless you have your vision magically restored. With your LD, it's really different. You may start out totally unable to cope, and you may gradually develop coping skills, and you may not need so much help at the end, especially if you're success-oriented. We see a lot of people that all they really need to do is to learn to write everything down. And once they conquer being able to spell, and once they develop their own note-taking system, which may be more, have more pictograms in it, They may go on to be totally successful and not really need all that help anymore. But we see a lot of other people who are, you know, they think every employer is going to have to provide them all sorts of assistance. So, you know, everybody's an individual. And, you know, not everybody I help is going to be successful. And some people I help are going to be successful beyond our wildest dreams and not even really need alternate media in a few years. More questions?
You're going to tell about the LD person in your brain.
Ah. Well, you know, the brain works in very mysterious ways. There is a wonderful story about a guy, I believe he went to Kenyatta College, dyslexic all his life, could barely read, really barely read, mixed up all the letters. You know, he maybe had a second grade reading ability, if that. He got in a horrible car accident and he lost his vision. And while he was in the hospital bed, he really couldn't do a whole lot, so he thought he'd try learning Braille, but he didn't expect much to happen. He learned Braille so fast. He was able to read faster, according to his teacher, than any blind adult she had ever taught. For some reason, the brain pathway that processed Braille was not the same brain pathway that processed print. So blindness, he has always said, was the best thing that ever happened to him. He was designed to be blind, and he reads fine now, and I don't know much about his life after that. He moved to the East Coast. I don't even know his name. I only knew the person who taught him Braille, but apparently he's very successful, reads aloud all the time, does public readings and stuff, and, you know, this was 15 years ago, so he's getting close to retirement now, but he went on to be very successful. More story and more questions? Whoops.
Coming. Just a minute. Go ahead. Does Deonza have any programs for teaching people how to be blind?
No. In fact, one of the things that happens at Deonza is we really work, as we often say, we work with people who have minimal or moderate disability. So we get a lot of people who are severely disabled, who have CP that's so severe that they cannot write or, you know, use their arms or hands at all. And it's always a gray area what you do with people whose disability is very debilitating. And if they have support from rehab, that's great, but we do get people who don't have that, and there's always a struggle. I mean, do we take notes for this person, or do we give them NCR paper? And so we don't really have anything to help people who are still sort of growing into their disability, if you know what I mean, who are getting comfortable with it, who are coming up with alternate techniques.
But Debbie, don't you still have...
Oh, sorry. Doesn't Deonza have classes for teaching visually impaired students how to use assistive technology on the computer?
Yes. Sorry about that. We actually have a whole computer training program for everybody. And then as an adjunct to it, there is an assistive technology component that people with disabilities are advised to take. They can choose not to, but then, of course, they couldn't access the computers. We teach Dragon. We teach JAWS. It's a sighted guy who does all that. Well, this is being recorded, but just between me and you, I think I probably know more JAWS than he does, and he knows more Dragon than I do. I sometimes fill in for him when he's not around, and if we're teaching a JAWS person, I just want to cringe because it's like, oh my, this is not the way to show the person. But whenever I have to teach a Dragon person, it's my turn to say, oh my, I don't know what I'm doing. So one of the things I have learned from that experience is don't call yourself an assistive technology specialist if all you know is JAWS, because there's a whole lot of other assistive technology out there you should know.
I have a question. Do you get much cooperation with rehab?
It depends, and I don't work directly with rehab. I am a worker bee. Above my level are something called counselors. Counselors are faculty, I'm staff, and there's a big division at Deonza. Staff are the workers, and faculty are the deciders. I am not a decider. I do not make decisions. In practice, I have some decisions I can make, but faculty are the counselors, and they are the ones who work directly with rehab. They are the guys with the degrees.
I have a question. This is Bev here. What is Dragon? I don't know these words.
There's Dragon, Naturally Speaking, and Dragon Dictate. They're both speech recognition. A large number of students have carpal tunnel. We get a lot of returning students with that. Or other, Roger, what's the technical term when you have a progressive condition, that repetitive use? Thank you, Roger. Repetitive stress injury, we have a lot of that. Some of them are our own faculty, actually. And one of the biggest assistive technologies that we do train is speech recognition so that they can continue to use the computer even if they are unable to type anymore. More questions?
Alan, I think back there was a question. Back in the left corner, way back.
Yeah.
Is the cost factor very high?
Cost factor?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, I don't understand the question.
Money-wise.
I know, but... cost of what?
The cost of learning. To go to school.
Oh, no, I mean, I think Deanza's charging, is it like $7 a unit now? It just went up, so... And again, because I'm not a counselor, I don't know all the details of this, but there's so much financial aid. I think Deanza's one of the best bargains in the universe. The big expense about going to college are the books, because Deanza tries very hard to keep the cost down. Of course, there is also this whole program for people on SSI or on other low-income. There's a whole fee waiver program. The biggest thing people should do if they're Deanza students is make sure they know about all the financial aid, the scholarships, the fee waivers, and it's scattered all over the place. You have to be a quester. You have to get out there and ask questions. People who do that really don't spend very much money.
There is a website called ICanAffordCollege.com, and it's for the community college systems. And there isn't any reason financially why somebody couldn't go to a community college in terms of the expense of the college. Now, there's the other things around your life, like rent and food, but if you are interested in a community college, that's set up specifically for that. And I'm pretty sure it's called ICanAffordCollege.com. It doesn't matter what your age is.
Yeah,
it's all one word.
Yeah, there are waivers there, and I don't know about all of that. My job is not to know that stuff, actually. My job is to know alternate media. But there are people in the college who know all that, and you can pretty much go to college on very low income. The books are a problem. The books are getting more and more expensive, so people really do need to find programs that will pay for their books, or they need to pick classes that without expensive books. And you can do that with a little bit of research. If you're a quester, like I said, you can find out what costs and what doesn't, and steer clear of the stuff that costs. More questions?
Yeah, this is, I'm sorry, this is sort of off the wall, but has anybody ever made a distinction between trying to learn courses online as against going to a community college and learning courses?
Right now, online tools are not particularly accessible to visually impaired people. In fact, the lady who is the director over at Chabot for Disabled Student Services is blind, and she is faculty, and she teaches several online courses. And the funniest thing I ever heard her say was that the system for administering the online course was perfectly accessible, but if she was a student, she couldn't take her own course. I don't know her name. I met her in a meeting and didn't catch it. I don't know this lady's name. I sat opposite her in a meeting and I just died laughing when she said, but I didn't catch her name.
Yes. Yes, Michelle.
I do know of some people who hope to get a copy of this program later. So if they have questions, additional questions for you, or if people here think of questions they want to ask you later, is there a way they can contact you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm here at these meetings all the time, and I'm going to give you my information, my home phone, and my last name. My last name right now is Norling, N-O-R-L-I-N-G, and I'm in the process of changing it to my married name, which is Armstrong, A-R-M-S-T-R-O-N-G. It'll probably take years because I'm, like, bad at paperwork, but it's happening slow. Foley. I'm in the phone book, and it's 408-956-9387. I'm happy to answer questions. I do have email, too. That's Debbie, D-E-B-E-E. That's three E's. At J, as in Joseph, F, as in Frank, C, as in Charlie, L, as in Locke. com. So that's Debbie at jfcl.com. I'm happy to answer email. I've got the world's best spam filter now, so I do keep up with my email. I have email at work as well. I'm open to the public at work. People can walk in. The public does deal with me. They can walk right in and look for me. I work in the Student Community Services Building on the De Anza campus. I'm there, depending on outreach, between supposedly 8:30 and 4:30. I have longer hours, but I always... Yeah, part of disabled students. I always tell people 8:30 to 4:30 just because of outreach. But I am, of course, there a little bit longer than that. I'm happy to answer any questions.
We have one more question.
Yeah, I have a question. Okay, Ken is my name. I'm very dumb at this. How does a person who's not sighted read things off a screen? I mean, is there a reader or a disc or something that helps you do that? How does it work?
Well, I use a speech synthesizer and a Braille display, so I don't have any trouble using the computer. Where I have trouble is dealing with print, and I am amazed. This job is more print than any job I've ever had before. And like most jobs, there's always parts of it that don't work so well. One of the big stressful things for me is doing everybody's final exams because I don't want to make any errors. But I, of course, don't always have someone to look at the printed test and tell me if the OCR results I get are right. So I scan the test, which means I take pictures of it, and I convert it into text. And I don't always know the text is right. So one of the things I have to do in my job, which is really a pain, is run around showing the print to people and going, what does question 28 say? What does choice B say? And, you know, there isn't, it's messy. There are parts of my job that are very, very messy that I just have to kind of, you know, punt and figure out how to solve it at the moment's notice. I have an occasional student worker, but as far as using the computer, I'm the computer whiz in our department, unfortunately. I'm not supposed to be. We have a whole ID department, but I'm the one who bails out my boss when she can't get her PowerPoint presentation loaded. And it's, you know, they're all social workers, and they don't barely know how to use the computer, so I'm it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Debbie. That was excellent.
Thank you.
We will take a 5-minute break. We have a very loaded meeting coming up. So in about 5 minutes, we'll start. Thank you.